Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, billions of dollars for roads, bridges, and internet broadband will be coming to Florida over the next 5 years. President Joe Biden will sign the bipartisan infrastructure bill into law on Monday.
It's a $1 trillion-plus national spending plan earmarking money for a long list of projects: transportation, public transit, electric vehicle recharging stations, and clean water projects are just among them. Now, there was a little bipartisan support for the bill, but not among the Florida congressional delegation. Democrats in the state voted for it. Republican congressmen and women voted against it. Governor Ron DeSantis described the legislation this way on Monday.
I think it was a lot of pork barrel spending from what I can tell.
But one of the Democrats hoping to unseat the governor next year, Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, called the new money a beginning.
This is a great starting place. Is it ever going to be enough? No. But certainly this is historic in what we can do moving forward.
So what needs to be fixed in your neighborhood? How could this new money impact your commute to and from work, to and from play? With an ever-growing population in Florida, more and more people moving in each week, each month, what's the priority to keep people and information safely moving around the Sunshine State? 305-995-1800. We begin this week with infrastructure spending. 305-995-1800. Join us on social media. Find us on Twitter. We're at Florida Roundup.
We'll go to your calls and tweets in a few minutes, but first with some details on how Florida might benefit from these funds, we welcome Alex Dougherty, Washington correspondent with the Miami Herald. Hey, Alex.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So $19 billion over several years is coming to Florida. We need to note that the Florida Department of Transportation says it's still too early to provide specifics about how these funds will be spent. But can you break down for us what we might expect, the allocations of dollars going all over Florida?
Yeah, so the biggest chunk of that $19 billion, about $13 billion or so, is going to go to rebuild roads and to expand roads throughout the state. So that's the biggest piece of the pie, so to speak. And the Florida Department of Transportation is correct. It's too early to determine what specific projects are going to get federal funds in this, you know, round of funding. But it's safe to say it's going to be significant. It's the biggest investment. The White House says it's the biggest investment in roads since the interstate highway system was approved in 1956. And we're looking at other investments as well in bridges, along with internet access. Those are the three biggest buckets in Florida. And there's also some other smaller pieces of funding that the state should see over the next 5 years.
Now, as we heard, the governor has called this money pork barrel spending. He says he'll oppose some of what's in the bill, like, for example, the creation of a voluntary pilot program that would study looking at a per mile user fee to improve roads. But on the other side, here's Democratic U.S. Representative Val Demings. She represents Florida's 10th district in Congress, hailing from the Orlando area. She'll be challenging Senator Marco Rubio for his Senate seat. Here's her reaction earlier this week to the infrastructure bill.
It took us a while to get it done, but we wanted to make sure that we got it right. And I certainly believe that we did. About $19 billion will come to Florida. We have about 3,500 miles of roadway and highway that are in poor condition, about 400 bridges that are in need of repair.
So, Alex, the governor calls it pork, but in the main, Florida city leaders and county leaders say they're eager to get these funds. What are you hearing from around the state?
Yeah, so it's going to be a huge investment that ultimately the state is going to have a large say on how that money is spent. So when the governor calls, you know, spending on roads, for example, pork barrel spending, you know, some of the programs he's identified are quite small within this larger bill. You know, entities like the Florida Department of Transportation and even individual members of Congress, as these funds move through the appropriations process, are going to have a big say in terms of how that money is directed. That certainly could mean, you know, someone could try to spend money on what's classically described as a pork barrel project. But I think there's wide agreement that, you know, a lot of this money is going to be spent on crucial upgrades to infrastructure. And that's why you saw this bill, at least initially, got 69 votes in the 100-member U.S. Senate, including from the Republican leader, Mitch McConnell. And this was something that was a priority for the Donald Trump administration. He was not able to accomplish it while he was president. So while the president, former president, came out in opposition to this bill, which led a lot of Republicans to oppose it, the broader priorities in this bill are something that Republicans and Democrats have largely agreed is something that needs to be fixed.
Right. Now, going beyond roads and bridges, which is something all of us can see and experience, let's talk about what else this bill will do. Tell us about how it will increase broadband internet access in Florida and what that really means for the people of this state.
Yes. Yeah, so the White House says the state of Florida is going to get $100 million to expand broadband internet coverage, which they say will give internet access to about 700,000 people in Florida who currently do not have it. But in addition to that, there's going to be internet subsidies that are given out to low-income individuals. Those are folks who are at 200% or below of the federal poverty line, which comes out to about $25,000 or so of income for a single person. Those folks would be eligible for a $30 a month internet subsidy to help them improve their access to internet. And that's something that'll be a nationwide program that billions of dollars are spent on. And obviously a significant amount of that is going to go to a state as large as Florida.
And that's a jobs and education piece. That's economic development. That's how the White House will sell that, right?
Right. I mean, it's infrastructure in the sense of, you know, the access to the internet is, you know, it might not be a road or a bridge, but I think at this point, it's fair to say that's a pretty crucial piece of our day-to-day lives. And so the White House is kind of saying, hey, this is infrastructure, even though it may not be a traditional, quote unquote, thing that we may think of like an airport or a road or a bridge. Their argument is, hey, look, you know, the internet now at this point is a piece of our daily lives and should be treated just like those things are.
Now, you mentioned airports. Florida's airports are getting money. Passenger, freight rail, they'll be getting some of these dollars. And as we talk about transportation overall, can you share with us how we expect the built environment for drivers to change around the state? Because we will be seeing far more electric vehicle charging stations to go in, so that people with electric or hybrid vehicles have a bigger network to play around with.
Yeah, so Florida will be getting about $200 million to expand its electric vehicle charging network. And there'll be some competitive federal grants that the state could apply for to get an additional slice of about $2.5 billion that would further expand that network. So it's definitely a priority of the administration to incentivize people to use and buy electric cars. There's a lot of debate about subsidies for actually purchasing vehicles. There's arguments even from some Democrats that, hey, look, you know, the people who can afford a Tesla probably don't need government help to do so. But this is actually for the charging network in and of itself. So if you're driving along the Florida Turnpike and you're running low on battery, there should be more opportunities to, you know, recharge your vehicle and be able to use it for longer trips without, you know, needing to also have a gas-powered car. So that's a big priority for the White House across the country to kind of, you know, expand our ability to use electric cars effectively over long distances.
One more big piece of this is water quality. Gina is calling us from Merritt Island. She wants to talk about how infrastructure money will improve Florida's water. Go ahead, Gina.
I think that everybody likes to buy to build roads, and that's all fine and all, but all the development of homes and businesses in our area, Central Florida, Brevard County in particular, is where I live, and I see it. All of this building and development is already overcome the water system treatment plant's ability to function and to provide what we need. They're constantly dumping into the Indian River Lagoon, and that's causing a decline in our economy because of all the tourism and recreation that is derived from that. So we really need to have a lot of that money put into the water treatment systems for Florida, since it's already going to have saltwater intrusion in our systems as it is now.
Thank you, Gina. Yeah. Alex, can you explain how this bill, once it becomes law, will help Floridians in terms of the quality of our water?
Yeah, so the state of Florida directly is going to get $1.6 billion over 5 years to improve drinking water infrastructure. That would be things like treatment plants to help improve the water quality that folks, you know, use in their homes. I think it's also important to note that there's a lot of pieces of this bill that are still up for debate in Congress as it moves through the funding process. One of those things related to water infrastructure would be Everglades funding. There's a lot of money that's not going directly to the state of Florida, but to the Army Corps of Engineers that controls Everglades reconstruction projects. Florida members are adamant that it's about $11.5 billion is going to the Corps, that about half of that money, $5 billion, should go to Florida so that their infrastructure projects related to Everglades restoration can get completed in the timeframes that they want to see happen. But obviously, that's a lot of discretion to the Corps. And is not directly in the hands of the state of Florida. So there's a lot of pieces of this bill that, you know, will have national effects and impacts, but where a federal agency, you know, not based in the state of Florida, may ultimately have a lot of say over how this money is spent.
A listener tweets the show, opportunities, get the grid updated, put in more underground lines, expand public transportation, upgrade schools. Well, thanks for the rundown on all of this, Alex Dougherty, Washington correspondent with the Miami Herald. Thanks for being with us here on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you.
We're talking about infrastructure spending and the billions of dollars likely headed to Florida in the next 5 years. President Joe Biden will sign the infrastructure legislation into law on Monday in Washington. Here on the Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800. What kind of infrastructure spending would you like to be seen done in your neighborhood, in your commute? 305-995-1800. Paul sends us a tweet at Florida Roundup. Water quality in Florida is a disaster. Drainage, sewage management is crucial. Sam sent us this note. Florida is in desperate need of affordable housing. I would like to see some of the money meet the housing needs, including infrastructure servicing new affordable housing. Send us your thoughts at Florida Roundup on Twitter. Now, compared to other states, Florida's hard infrastructure, roads and bridges, are actually in pretty good shape. The American Society of Civil Engineers gave Florida's infrastructure a C grade, higher than the national grade. And the biggest infrastructure need is focused on water. Sufi Boyle is with us, president of the Florida section of American Society of Civil Engineers. Welcome to the program. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What's behind the C grade in Florida, average, and should that be something we should be proud about here in Florida?
Well, I have two kids, and if either one of them brought me a C average report card, I don't think I'd be too pleased with it.
Fair enough.
So from that perspective, a C is what we call something that's mediocre and needs attention. Grading the report card from A to F, A being exceptional and fit for the future, and F failing or critical. So a C is pretty much, yeah, you're kind of going along and you might be okay for a while, but you really should start focusing on improvements.
Probably the most visible infrastructure that we use every day are roads. The majority of the money that is likely to come to Florida with this new infrastructure spending will be spent on roads. They're generally in pretty good shape here in Florida. We don't suffer from the freeze and thaw cycle like 49 other states can. So how are Florida roads handling the continuously increasing demand from population growth?
And that's something that's, you know, that's difficult to contend with. Planning for roads generally takes a long time. So by the time you're actually constructing, the need might have increased some. Roads in general have received a C+. The FDOT is actually doing a tremendous job keeping up with the assets. Specifically, you see that in bridges, which received a B grade. Mm. In general, we have very few failing bridges.
And what about the idea of the majority of this infrastructure spending is going to be spent on roads? When looking at the future, as you mentioned, that A grade that the American Society of Civil Engineers looks at is really fit for the future. Is it road construction? Is it road reconstruction that needs to happen to be fit for the future of transportation in Florida?
It's a little bit of both. So the way that the report is graded, It's based on certain criteria, things like capacity, future needs, resilience, innovation. What kind of road systems are you looking at to improve the quality of the road and also the longevity of the road? So those things all come into play, and Florida is ahead of the national curve on those issues.
And how about environmental conditions? How do they play into how structures and roads and bridges age here?
Well, we certainly do see more damage occurring on coastal systems, not only from sea level rise, but from salt intrusion. You do get sea spray, and it does affect the concrete. It does affect anything that's not well protected. So some of those systems might need more help. But there are needs everywhere.
Yeah, on the coastline and away from the coastline. Of course, there's plenty of it here on the peninsula in Florida. We're speaking with Sufi Boyle, president of the Florida section of the American Society of Civil Engineers, out with their grade of infrastructure in Florida, a C grade, average, mediocre is what that C grade means, according to the Society of Civil Engineers. The report, Sufi, finds that water is the infrastructure needing the most investment. We heard from Gina in Merritt Island just a few moments ago on the phone about the kinds of water investments she'd like to see in her local community with this new infrastructure spending bill at the federal level. What types of investments around water are of the highest priority in Florida?
Well, with water, we have three categories that we looked at: drinking water, stormwater, and wastewater. Stormwater being a C minus, just because a lot of municipalities don't have a stormwater plan that they can account for the way that the water moves around their system. We also do see with wastewater, while we have some really great facilities in urban areas, some of the rural areas that are still using septic or drainage fields do contribute some to some of the surface water issues that we're seeing.
Yeah, and not even just rural areas. In some places in urban South Florida, septic tanks still remain the only choice for wastewater.
Right.
And what about keeping up with population gains overall? You mentioned that regarding roadways, but what about the demand on our water systems as we continue to see Florida's population, 21 million now and climbing?
Right. So for drinking water, there has been a pretty good investment in water infrastructure. And as far as meeting the demands, we are still able to meet the demands into the future, not as much into the future as we'd like to see, but there's still capacity and there's still opportunity for more growth.
How far into the future? I mean, when do things start to become perhaps more concerning than they are now?
That I don't really have an answer for specifically.
Yeah, that's the problem with predictions, right, Sufi? They're
yes.
About the future. That's the problem with predictions.
Yeah, no crystal ball around here.
No, none at all. But certainly but a report card about Florida's infrastructure, that we have from the American Society of Civil Engineers. Sufi Boyle is the president of the Florida section. Sufi, much appreciated. Thanks for sharing that report card with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Talking about infrastructure here, Angel tweeting us, the need for affordable housing is dire. My mother's on the Section 8 waiting list, 7,000 applicants for 65 openings at a new housing project. Continue to send your thoughts at Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800. We're going to be talking about the changing of mask requirements in Florida schools and education as the pandemic continues. It's next on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for listening this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
In Miami, I'm Tom Hudson. Masks can now come off for Florida students who have been required to wear them for many months as the pandemic continues. The virus still is spreading, but infection rates have fallen, and younger children are now eligible to be vaccinated. School districts that ignored pressure from the state's Department of Education and required students to wear masks have begun easing those rules.
Leon Superintendent Rocky Hanna defied Governor Ron DeSantis's ban on mask mandates at the start of the school year by requiring students to wear face coverings. The only way parents could opt out was by having a physician sign off on it. The district held on to its policy even as the state threatened to fine school board members and lawsuits raged in the courts. Leon, along with six other school districts, sued the state last month, even as the district changed its policy, no longer requiring a doctor's note. An administrative judge recently ruled against the districts and said the state's rules on student masking strike a balance in keeping kids safe. In a statement, Hanna said the district, quote, no longer believes it's prudent for us to pursue a short-term legal remedy to determine where the line is drawn between state rights and the rights of our local school system. The superintendent says the district will continue to push for local control. Leon's withdrawal leaves only four districts continuing with the appeal: Miami-Dade, Broward, Alachua, and Duval. I'm Len Hatter.
So that's the latest, folks. Now, this week, the largest school districts in the state dropped their mask mandates, allowing all students to stop wearing them if they so choose. Alberto Cavallo is the superintendent of schools in Miami-Dade County.
We are ready to relax the mandatory mask protocol to include an unqualified, unlimited parent opt-out provision.
So is the masks in schools battle finally over in the state? Let's keep in mind, the Centers for Disease Control still recommends masks for all students and teachers when they're inside. What protocols are your kids or your grandchildren maybe following in class? What are your thoughts about all of this? Call us up now, statewide, live, here on the Florida Roundup. The number to join the show, 305-995-1800. Tweet us, at Florida Roundup.
We'd love to hear your thoughts, what you are practicing here, especially if you're a teacher, if you're a parent, grandparent, have someone in school, live near a school. What are you experiencing there? 305-995-1800. Ryan Daly is with us, reporter for News Service of Florida, and Andrew Atterbury, education reporter for Politico Florida. Ryan, let me start with you and the status of the legal cases, a few of them, but that lawsuit that some school districts filed against the state to allow them to mandate masks. Administrative court judge ruled in favor of the state that it did have the ability to ban mask mandates. Will there be an appeal? What's the status of this case moving forward?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me. I just real quick want to give some background on how we got here, you know, because as you mentioned, there have been multiple court cases and it's sort of been a somewhat of a long and winding road, but it's all flowing from Governor DeSantis's executive order issued July 30th that aimed to give parents the choice on whether students wear masks in schools. And then days before the start of the school year, the Department of Health issued an emergency rule that said parents should have the right to opt out of mask requirements. Now, there was somewhat of a loophole, I guess you could say, in that rule, because it didn't expressly say that school districts couldn't require that a doctor's note be submitted for what's been called a medical opt-out. Mm-hmm. And then subsequently on September 22nd, the Department of Health issued a new version, I suppose you could say strengthening that mask rule, that did say expressly that the decision for students to wear masks should be at the sole discretion of a parent or guardian.
Right. And that rule was the real focus of the lawsuits that a few of the school districts filed against the state, saying that the school districts, the local school boards, had the ability to put in public health measures for their students.
That is correct. Yes. On October 6th, it was six school boards filing that challenge in the Division of Administrative Hearings, arguing in part that the Department of Health overstepped its legal authority in issuing that emergency rule. Now, ultimately, like you mentioned, Administrative Law Judge Brian Newman sided with the state and wrote that the school boards failed to prove that the parental opt-out provisions in the Department of Health rule facilitated the spread of COVID-19 in schools. But the and like you heard Lynn Hatter report, at least one district has dropped out of the appeal, but the remaining school boards quickly moved forward with an appeal that's in the 4th District Court of Appeal. Mm-hmm. And on Wednesday, the appeals court denied a request by the school boards to expedite the appeal, but that appeal is ongoing.
And they're appealing the decision, even as they're also repealing their own local mask mandates for students, as we heard the superintendent of Miami-Dade County, Broward County, making also that decision this week. Andrew Atterbury, let me bring you into the conversation. Several school districts were fined by the state for ignoring that state prohibition. What's the latest on that?
Sure. And thanks for having me. There's no place I'd rather be than hanging out with y'all on this Friday afternoon. So, yeah, this is kind of getting messy here, because when they, at first, the Florida Department of Education, they decided to dock the monthly paychecks of school board members in Broward and Alachua. Those are the two school boards that really were the first to mandate masks against the wishes of the governor and the other folks out there. And once they did that, that's when the Biden administration got in, and it kind of started this whole proxy war between the U.S. Department of Education and the Florida Department of Education. So once the federal government decided to send some grants to Broward and Alachua to offset those funds, the Florida Department of Education did not like that very much. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of letters going back and forth. The Florida Department of Ed said that the federal government should stay off of their turf practically. And then they went ahead anyway, the Florida Department of Education did, and they took grants, federal grants, from both those counties. And after that is when it gets even hairier, which I know it's hard to believe. But the U.S. Federal Department of Education sent a cease and desist to Florida to get them to stop taking these federal grants. And this is in a pretty obscure place that a lot of people probably have never even heard of, but this is being worked out in like a federal administrative law court that's specifically for the Federal Education Agency.
Yeah.
And sorry.
It's a fascinating, wide ranging debate with a lot of legal avenues in it, but it does get down to ultimately who in Florida can make those decisions, both on a agency government level and also parental involvement here. We're talking about masks.
Bingo.
Again. Yeah, it's at the heart of all of it here, as the larger school districts in Florida that had mandatory mask rules in place have eased those in the last several weeks. 305-995-1800 here on the Florida Roundup. 305-995-1800.
We'll go to your calls in a moment. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. You know, Ryan Daly, a new service of Florida, when you talk to some of these superintendents and school board members, they really did see this as taking a stand for local control. I mean, as Tom pointed out, some of these districts relaxed mandates even as they continued to battle the state on this. For them, it was about more than student and teacher and staff public health and safety, although they say they were primarily motivated by that. They wanted to keep the mask mandates going to buy time for the virus to decline. But what they'll tell you really is that they just felt ideologically that they should get to make these decisions at the local level. Isn't that really at the heart of this whole flap?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you listened in on some of these court cases and just the larger debate going on, it certainly the local control aspect came into play. And some of these school officials, you know, have said numerous times, you know, pointed to a constitutional obligation to provide safe schools. And the argument was, you know, we are going forward with our plan that we've drawn up to provide safe schools for students and staff, and teachers. And, you know, I think they saw the state as being heavy-handed coming in with the Department of Health rule seeking to prevent those mask mandates. And in the run-up to the school year, that I think was a priority for Governor DeSantis, even prior to him issuing his executive order in late July. He had made comments to the effect of, we're going to have a normal school year, and that means no masks. And, you know, Florida, huge state, we've got 67 county school districts. you know, each with varying levels. And down in South Florida, I'm sure you can attest to having had perhaps at times a more intense spread of COVID-19 than maybe less populated, more rural areas of the state. So I think there was another element of the argument from local school officials saying, we're dealing with our own local conditions. We should be able to, you know, implement these COVID-19 mitigation measures as we see fit. And I think that debate, although case numbers pretty much across the board in Florida have been dwindling, I think that debate is still active.
Certainly. 305-995-1800. Call us up, Florida. Jamie on the line from Tampa. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Melissa. How are you?
We're great. Thanks. Thanks for calling.
No problem. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. So I actually like this idea of kind of it gives parents an option. Hey, do you want your kid to wear it? Do you not want to? I actually know some kids who have autism or things where they cannot have a mask on all day, every day. And one thing I will say is this for parents, you know your kid best. You know what they will and will not take, and so you have to make decisions accordingly. I think that a lot of the districts who dropped their mandate, I think they're saying, look, let's let the parents decide. Let's let the parent decide if that kid has a mask or not. Let's leave it up to the people who ultimately are the ones bringing the kids to school. Let's go ahead and let them pick and choose rather than us choosing it for them. And again, I know kids who have autism and other sensory disabilities where a mask may not work, where they won't keep, especially autism. Some of those kids, depending on how bad their autism is, may not be able to cope with what's happening to them. So you have, so it's good that we have the option of whether they have it or whether they don't. I think that's a good idea to have. You know, and for those who want to wear them, they have the option to do so. For those who don't kind of wearing it all day, those parents, those families, they have the option to
all right,
opt
Jamie.
Out. And I think that's pretty good thinking.
Yeah. Jamie, thank you for calling from Tampa, and you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Okay, Andrew Atterbury, that caller, Jamie, got to the heart of what we've been seeing at school board meetings, not just across Florida, but across the country. As parents insist on getting to make these decisions on behalf of their own children, school boards pushed back at the height of the pandemic and said public health conditions were paramount. Now, though, parents, by and large, will get to make these decisions on behalf of their kids. And, you know, it's just been fascinating to watch the political center of discourse really shift to schools and school boards. Parents angry about the mask mandates, Andrew. They've also sort of rolled that into overall anger about critical race theory being taught in schools, even though it isn't being taught in schools for the most part. But what are your thoughts as an education reporter about how schools and school boards have become at the cultural center of this divide we see in this country?
Sure. And you're seeing education play out politically in these like major races, like Virginia's governor's, their gubernatorial election, right? Like people are talking, they want to know more about what their kids are learning in school. And it seems like people want to have a bigger voice in that. So when you have a governor like Governor Ron DeSantis, like people are, he's really leaning into that, it looks like. One thing that I thought was really interesting, the timing of all of these last few holdouts of school districts reversing course on their masks. I mean, there's this special session coming up next week in Florida, in Tallahassee. Everybody's going to be in town. And one of the big pieces of the changes they're trying to make is they want to give parents the ability to sue any school board that's making their kid wear a mask or quarantine them against the parents' wishes. And that is pretty clear cut. That could be a major blow financially to school boards. And already we've seen a couple, and you can't say, oh, this is right, this is because of the session, but that's a pretty daunting penalty for some folks.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes financially. So just before, ahead of that, I mean, that starts on Monday. just a couple of days before that, all these schools, they changed their tune pretty quick.
Andrew, we're going to ask you more about education in the special session coming up. But in Melbourne, Terry is on line four. Go ahead, Terry. You've got a thought on just this topic.
Well, it's just a tough situation here where we have all this political rancor surrounding what should basically be a relatively objective public health decision. And for example, if my child is in school, it doesn't simply boil down to whether someone else's child should have the right to wear a mask or not, because if the child that doesn't wear a mask obviously is going to be exposing my child, even if he or she does wear a mask. And here in Melbourne, we've had real rancor at our school board meetings and abuse of at least one school board member, both online and in other phases of her life. And I just think it's really unfortunate that we can't get on the same plate, figure out what's best for health, and go from there.
Yeah, Terry, I appreciate that perspective there from Melbourne. You know, Ryan, when the Miami-Dade County Public School Superintendent announced this week that it was dropping its mask mandate, the superintendent pointed to the science, the drop in infection rate, drop in hospitalizations, increase in vaccinations, talked about the gate criteria that had been sent out, set out as kind of markers to make a decision. So we got about a minute or so before we have to take a break here. But what role is the decision to uphold the state's ban playing in some of these district decisions, at least publicly stated by the superintendents and school board members?
I think the answer, that's a good question. I think the answer to that is probably complicated or nuanced, because Miami-Dade wasn't entirely unique in that regard, and that I believe they laid out some public health benchmarks.
Correct.
that they would have to hit, you know, a particular rate of cases per 100,000 people or whatever metric they were using. And as some of these court cases have been playing out, as has been pointed out already, the case numbers have been dwindling after that huge summer surge with the Delta variant. So I think it's a combination of both. But when Alachua County dropped its requirement this past week, they did cite the school board member who called the special meeting, said, you know, we might not have a path forward in the courts.
Ryan, hold on. We're going to talk more about masks and education in Florida schools next. We're back on the Florida Roundup, and thanks for supporting public broadcasting in your community. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Join us now on the Florida Roundup. Give us a call, 305-995-1800. Tweet us at Florida Roundup as we continue the conversation with Ryan Daly, reporter with News Service of Florida. Andrew Atterbury, he covers education for Politico Florida. Now, guys, we were talking about the whole mask mandate battle in Florida schools. Let's look ahead on the calendar now to next week. It was extraordinary to see a spokeswoman at the White House Tuesday say that she believes that this special session in Florida targeting vaccination and mask mandates is not a good idea. Karine Jean-Pierre told reporters at the White House that, and I'm quoting, she said, "Why are these legislators, these Republicans, getting in the way of saving lives?" Now, at the same time, gentlemen, last week we had a state representative on the show, a very conservative one, Representative Sabatini of Lake County. He told us not everyone in the Republican caucus in Tallahassee is on board with the governor's special session on vaccine mandates. And that may be due to feedback they're getting from constituents. For example, you know, the other day I interviewed the owner of a yoga studio in Ponte Vedra Beach here in North Florida, where I'm sitting. She's offering a couple of vaccinated-only yoga classes on her schedule. That landed her on a list of dozens of businesses and entities around the state that could be facing hefty fines from Florida for ignoring the ban that the governor passed on vaccine mandates. And so I'd like to begin with you, Ryan, about this. We're even hearing that the governor wants to take Florida out of OSHA to set up our own Occupational Health and Safety Administration, although he's certain to get some pushback about that in this special session. What do you think might come out of this week-long session, given all of these undercurrents?
Well, the House and Senate on Monday rolled out some proposals for the special legislative session that I think kind of give a look ahead. You know, some summaries were released by the House and Senate of a series of bills. And I mean, the rundown kind of looks like, you know, ensuring workers can receive exemptions from employer required vaccinations. We talked about a little bit earlier, the Parents' Bill of Rights, reinforcing the state's Parents' Bill of Rights law to shield school children from mask and vaccination mandates, preventing government employers from requiring workers to be vaccinated against COVID-19. And then, like I believe you mentioned, trying to move forward with withdrawing from the federal OSHA oversight, and also
Is that actually likely to make it through the process, though? That's my question about the OSHA piece.
To be quite honest with you, I'm not exactly sure of the chances, but I'm sure there will be some sizable Republican support for it, given that the governor has that legislative leaders have come out in support of that.
It's my understanding that let's say Florida decides, okay, we're not going to pay attention to anything OSHA says anymore. Florida has to ask the federal government for permission to not follow the rules of the federal government. So that's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
I mean, I guess so. I would say that, yeah, no, that's that is pretty extraordinary.
305-995-1800, our statewide phone number. We're talking about the special session coming up next week here by Florida lawmakers. And part of that special session, they will be focused on COVID-19 vaccines and educational institutions. 305-995-1800, a number of the school districts that had mask mandates in place to begin the school year have begun repealing them and easing those restrictions. Let's go to Philip in Jacksonville on line 3. Philip, thanks for calling and holding. You're on the radio.
In regards to parental consent, let's say I'm a teenage driver and my parents tell me that not only do I need to wear a mask, but I don't have to stop at a stop sign, I don't have to stop at a red light, and I don't have to wear a seatbelt. What's the governor say to those things?
Yeah, where's the line when it comes to parental choice? Michael in Tallahassee on line 2. Go ahead, Michael. You're on the radio.
I had a similar question. I'm wondering if parents are able to opt out of masks by that they have parental choice in schools. What's the difference between having students be allowed to wear what they want in terms of dress code, which is another issue of personal choice that may be governed by parents?
Great questions there from Michael and Philip, 305-995-1800. Andrew Atterbury with Politico Florida. How does the governor, how do his supporters about this parental choice, parental health care choice, answer those kinds of quote-unquote slippery slope scenarios?
I mean, if they had to, they'd probably say, why don't you get a voucher and go to a private school or something and find a school that better suits your needs, which is kind of like the MO right now. But for them, I mean, right now, it just seems like the parental rights things is a really popular topic, and they're really riding that wave right now. Because people are, like you talked about earlier, the school boards, I've never seen the intensity and the people attending these school board meetings trying to get involved. And a lot of it, sure, is gonna be really like angry and a lot of passion that maybe shouldn't be there. But I've just never seen this kind of surge locally. So people really want, at least the vocal people, really want their rights like this, their parents to have these rights like right. this, whether it's masks or even quarantines. Like, they don't like their kids having to stay home and miss class if they're asymptomatic. So I'm really interested to see how this plays out with what they're doing at the special session.
Aren't we on a collision course, though, between the parental bill of rights, particularly as it relates to health care, and the constitutional language in Florida about a safe education?
And that was a lot of the arguments around the parental bill of rights when it passed originally. But it was written to be kind of vague, and that's why even during a lot of these court cases challenging the mask mandate, the ban against mask mandates, they're trying to say the same thing. Hey, this bill doesn't outright say anything about mask mandates, which is true. But now, if they're going to write a law that says if your kid's forced to mask, you can sue your school board, that's as clear as it gets. And that may not even really even step on anything else other than mask mandates and quarantine. So it looks like they kind of got a workaround going on here. And that's really the only, as far as I understand, those are the only thing really in the special session that touches on schools. It's just those couple lines about you can just giving people the right to sue their school board.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Now, as you mentioned, so much of the energy is around schools, but let's talk about the other side of this, the business community, and what lawmakers are hearing from business owners wanting to have control. We got a statement this morning from Leading Age Florida, the only association representing the entire continuum of care for older adults regarding the mandates. And they noted that during the special session, legislation that would restrict mandates for employers would make it impossible for health care providers to be in compliance with both state and federal guidance unless an exemption is put in place. They say nursing homes must comply with the federal rule and that the loss of Medicaid and Medicare funding would be devastating to providers and could ultimately displace Florida's most frail elders. So, guys, there are competing constituencies when it comes to this legislation that the state is going to be contemplating. Your thoughts?
Oh, sure. Hey, well, it seems like there's a lot of slippery slopes here. And if you just look at the last couple of sessions, one thing I'm already prepared for is once this special session ends, you know, when are the lawsuits going to begin?
Right.
You just got to expect no matter what happens next week, there's going to be people who don't like some of that stuff. And it may have, like you said, may have some really adverse effects on them. And you could probably expect some folks to sue over these things. And we could be back here talking about this exact same thing next year, honestly, with the way things are going.
Right.
But I think there's going to be a lot of back and forth like that.
Yeah. Like I say, business owners who liked the way the governor handled the pandemic in the beginning, some of them now say we don't want to be fined if we're making decisions regarding safety in our workplace that we think make the most sense for our workforce, for our customers. That's a different kettle of fish than I think what lawmakers are hearing from parents about the school piece of it. Andrew Atterbury, in the short time we have left, your thoughts?
Sure. They're majorly different issues. I like you said earlier, I focus a little bit more on schools than businesses, but I think that they're going to have a lot of people trying to get that perspective in next week. But the problem is that this stuff is all going to be done in a very short amount of time, it looks like. I mean, it's just next week. And it looks like a lot of this stuff is going to be worked out on the floor. I don't know exactly where the committees are going to go. So it's going to be a grind for people to really get their perspective in on this, because it seems like it's coming so fast.
It really is. And the part about actually pulling out of OSHA, I think, out of everything that's going to be contemplated, is the one that is most fascinating, because how likely is the federal government to tell Florida, no, you can't leave the purview of the federal government? I mean, they would have to ask permission if they were to pass that at the statewide level. So lots to watch next week as we look at this. And I want to thank you both for being with us, sharing your insights. Ryan Daly, reporter with News Service of Florida, with us. And we were also joined by Andrew Atterbury, education reporter with Politico Florida. Gentlemen, have a great weekend, and thank you so much for sharing your thoughts here on the Florida Roundup today.
Thank you.
And thanks.
Thanks. And thanks to everyone who called and tweeted the show. That is our show, the Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Andrea Podomro are show producers. Catherine Hobbs is our associate producer.
WLRN's Director of Radio Operations and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Engineering help each and every week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks for listening. Have a safe weekend. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next Friday at noon.